Wake up, sleepyheads. It's party time!
This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Most metal episode of Junk Food Cinema we have as yet recorded here on FilmSchoolRejects.com. This is, of course, the weekly cult and exploitation filmcast that is so good, it just has to be fattening. I'm your host, Brian Salisbury, and joining me, as per usual, is my friend, co-host, and rhythm guitar section himself, Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
No wimps. No false metal.
No false metal! Sammy Kerr would not take kindly to false metal, and neither do we! But we do offer a wide assortment of back episodes on iTunes as well as Stitcher, and you can follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema, as well as like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. And if you really like the podcast, please consider becoming a patron, patreon.com/junkfoodcinema. Every week we do bonus episodes just for our patrons, and we currently have a flex goal out there. If we hit $300 an episode, we are going to do basically what is tantamount to a truth or dare situation where you guys can send me movies and I have to watch and review anything you send me. It's cinemasochism at its most horrific. And I have every faith in the world that you guys will send me some atrocious shit.
I know they will.
Without a doubt. Without a doubt. But turning to this week's episode, I am so excited about this for a number of reasons.
How happy were you that I showed this?
I was very happy. This is a movie that I actually saw at a Terror Tuesday several years ago and thought was fucking rad. So that's one. I already knew it was great. The second being, it delves into one of my favorite weird subgenres of horror, which is the heavy metal horror movie,
right?
Which we'll talk a little bit about. And then, of course, the other reason this is a very special episode is that it was your birthday screening.
Yes.
At the Alamo Draft House.
This is the annual, this is the crazy shit that Cargill pulled out of his ass, birthday screening. In previous years, of course, you guys will be familiar with all of these wonderful, actually there's one we have not covered yet and we really need to.
Okay.
But so, in previous birthdays, I showed Sorceress.
Yes,
on 35 millimeter. I showed Can't Stop the Music.
Yep.
I showed Skate Town USA.
Also true.
I did last year show a 1981 revival print of Star Wars without any updated special effects. And the one thing we've never talked about on the show, Creepers.
Creepers. Well, we've talked about it. I think it's come up several times. We've never given it its own episode.
Phenomena slash Creepers, which we really should do at some point.
Agreed.
Take a drink, because that is definitely a movie. But this year, I was like, you know what? Let me tie this into the summer of '86. We have had so much fun watching a different movie from, you know, my childhood every week for the entire summer and covering it. And I was like, you know what? I've always wanted to see this movie. I've only seen bits and pieces of it. It's been unavailable on any format for years. You can buy used copies of the bullshit 2007 release.
Oh boy.
Never been put on DVD or on Blu-ray because it's caught up in music rights issues, as was the case of two other movies that I have played in the past. And so I was like, yeah, this is right. Like, let's do Trick or Treat. And then that also gives us something to talk about on the show. So
absolutely.
I watched a little bits and pieces of this and I was like, oh yeah, I'm definitely in. This is how I want to watch it. I want to watch it on 35. We'll show it at the Draft House at midnight on a Saturday. And sure enough, the print, oh my God, this 35 millimeter print looked like a 4K fucking projection.
It was pretty.
Fucking gorgeous.
It was pretty.
The only flaws it had was at the end of some of the reels, it got a little chewed up, as is expected.
Yeah.
But like for a few seconds, and then it goes back to being like pristine, like it's fucking 1986 and you're watching it in the movie theater for the first time. As one of my buddies turned around and said, yes, it's as if it was hardly ever played in the theater.
Strange how it seems like people don't regularly, put this one on. But yes, again, This is, of course, Trick or Treat.
Rock and roll will never die. At least not this Halloween.
You've heard of raising spirits from the dead by incantations, right?
I guess.
I did that by playing a record backwards.
You're kidding.
Sammy Kerr. His fans won't let him die. He won't let them live. Trick or treat.
Looks like we better check out the party punch.
Which, no, we're not talking about the...
not Trick or Treat.
No, not the anthology horror film from a few years ago.
Not the fantastic anthology horror film, which apparently has a sequel coming up soon.
I can't wait for that. This is
Trick or Treat.
Trick or Treat. Fully grammatically correct, Trick or Treat, which is, again, a movie that exists in one of my favorite weirdo subgenres of heavy metal horror.
Not just, it's a couple different subgenres because it's heavy metal horror, it's horror comedy,
yeah,
and to top it off, it is cautionary tale horror.
Well, see, and that's what I love about heavy metal horror is 9 times out of 10, it is made by people who don't know what heavy metal is, so they are making cautionary tales. And what you get is you get this weird sort of, like, youth panic going on. Like, one of my favorite
like
movies...
Madness.
Yeah, like, one of my favorite movies of this subgenre is Demons, Dario Argento's kid made. And I'm sorry, Mario Bava's kid made, Lamberto Bava. But it's one of those things that when you watch the movie, it's got an amazing, just absolutely fantastic heavy metal score that has Billy Idol among so many others. There's some Lemmy on there. Like, it's an incredible soundtrack. But the characters that represent heavy metal culture in that movie are fucking bonkers from another planet. It makes no sense whatsoever. And that is kind of my favorite thing about these movies is they usually are cautionary tales about how heavy metal is like the pathway to destruction and how it's going to open all these evil doors. And this movie has that storyline set up, but clearly made by somebody poking fun very subtly at points of the whole idea that heavy metal is like the path to youth destruction. And
oh yeah, this movie gets what it is on so many levels.
Absolutely. Like,
we'll talk about it. This is what's fantastic about this movie. This is a movie that on the surface is has all the makings of being a crafter piece.
Yeah, absolutely.
It is one of those movies where you have all the elements for a Friday night. This is a bullshit movie that we're going to throw on and not think about. And instead, it is a movie that knows that's what people think it's going to be.
Yeah.
And it plays with those expectations. It understands heavy metal. It understands the culture. It knows the bands. It gets who these kids are and why they're attracted to. It's one of the best elements. We'll get into that. But it also is very funny about itself, and it understands horror movies and understands the rules of horror movies. It knows exactly what it needs to do at all the right moments to make this movie work and is consistently, legitimately funny about it.
Absolutely.
And everything fires on all cylinders. Like, the only complaint I heard about this movie the other night was one of my friends who is a professional effects wizard here in Austin, Meredith Johns. She works with Rodriguez. She's her big claim to fame. One of the greatest things she ever did was she was the person who came up with and made the intestine repelling gag from Machete.
Okay.
Yeah, she's fucking genius. And she was like, that movie's so good. The prosthetics are a little weak. And I was like,
you don't say.
I was like, well, come on. And she's like, yeah, yeah, yeah. And she knew who the prosthetics artist was. And he's like, he's always much better than that. He's a genius. This is the guy who did Alien. The guy who did Alien did these prosthetics?
Yeah.
What is going on in this movie?
The difference being the guy who worked on Alien didn't have Dino De Laurentiis his budget and De Laurentiis' oversight telling him what to do.
Yeah. That said, that's like the complaint about this movie. Like literally any problem you would have with this movie is some of the cheapness of it. Aside from that, it's a movie that wants to entertain the living fuck out of you and does.
Yeah. Not to put too fine a pun on it, but this movie fucking rocks. Like, from start to finish, it's so enjoyable. And I think the thing we were talking about how it has a sense of humor and doesn't take itself too seriously It is the directorial debut of, and as soon as this name came on the screen,
oh yeah,
I was like, wait a minute.
Yeah.
Charles Martin Smith. I'm like, I know that name, but not from filmmaking.
No,
I know that name as an actor somewhere.
Well, he's an actor who's been in like 200 movies. You would recognize so much stuff. I'm sure you pulled up the list already.
Oh, yeah.
Hit us with 12 of the things that everyone fucking knows him from.
You've probably seen a little film called Starman. You've probably seen a little film called The Untouchables, which I think is probably where most people know him from. He was Oscar Wallace, the sort of nerdy accountant member of the Untouchables, whose death scene is actually really moving. Like, it's a big part of that movie. He's kind of, you know what, he's the Agent Coulson of the Untouchables.
Oh, yeah.
Because his death kind of spurs everything forward. But he's been on The X-Files, Deep Cover, Deep Impact, movies without the word deep in them.
He was pretty much cut from the movie. He's the wolf in Wolf Biederman.
There you go.
Like he's the guy who discovers that gets the kid's letter, looks up the thing, then goes racing down the hill, dying in a car accident, so that nobody discovers the asteroid for a little while.
So yeah, he's been in a ton of movies. He's a very kind of nebbish, nerdy guy. That's kind of the role he plays most often.
But as a director,
oh boy,
holy God, the director of this directed. I'm just going to name three films that's going to make you go, "What the fuck?" right now. Air Bud,
yeah, what the
fuck? A Dolphin Tale,
what the fuck?
And A Dolphin Tale 2. This is a heavy metal horror film that fires on all cylinders, made by the guy who would go on to make movies that utter the phrase, "There's no rules about dogs playing football."
There are no rules is actually kind of that. I hate that this connection works, but he kind of made this movie like there were no rules. And that kind of worked out for him really well.
Yeah, no, this movie, not really. I mean, he made a good movie that made $6 million in the box office, and we can't find it.
Well, when I
DVD
say worked
anywhere.
Out really well, I mean that we're talking about this movie on a podcast in 2016, which is more than I think anybody could have possibly said for it. But the basic plot here is that you have a character whose name, I'm just going to preface this now, I'm going to sow the seed right now, caused a lot of issue at one point during the movie, if you don't enunciate it correctly, Eddie Weinbauer. Played by Mark Price. Now, Mark Price...
Hold on.
Yeah.
He's not Eddie Weinbauer.
That's the name of the character.
He's Ragman.
Oh, I'm sorry. Ragman.
Ragman!
As he self-identifies, is a heavy metal outcast, doesn't really fit in his school. What was the show he was on? Family Ties? As Skippy?
Yeah, he was on Family Ties. And before
Skippy from Family Ties.
Oh, this is that movie with the kid from Family Ties. I would like to point out that the movie with that guy from Family Ties could also be descriptions of such films as Tremors and Back to the Future.
Yeah.
So this is smack dab between those two, and I would put it up there with as enjoyable as both of them.
So we'll call this a movie starring the guy from Family Ties,
with
not
a
the
guy
movie.
Family Guys.
Not the movie starring the guy from Family Ties.
Like, Tina Yothers was the only one from that show that never got a shot.
Poor Tina Yothers.
Like, Mark Price at least got his shot. It may not have worked out, but he got his shot. Tina Yothers doesn't have her, she doesn't have her trick-or-treat.
A moment of silence for Tina Yothers' career. Okay, so Mark Price, Eddie Weinbauer, is, like I said, he's an outcast at school. He gets picked on because apparently he goes to the one school in the nation where only one kid likes heavy metal, and there are no nerds, no Star Trek geeks.
That's not true. That's not true. His best friend is a nerd who likes heavy metal.
Then why are all the jocks picking on Eddie Weinbauer? That's what I don't understand in this movie
off
the bat.
Because jocks in the 80s were not metalheads. That metalheads was a separate thing. When in the 80s, as somebody who lived through the 80s and
take us in the Wayback Machine, Professor.
Yeah, I'm getting in the Wayback Machine and I'm going to drop my geek cred here. My very first concert I ever went to was Iron Maiden Anthrax. It was on the Persistence of Time tour for Anthrax.
Both of those bands have posters that at some point show up during this movie,
they
by the
do.
Way.
Anthrax being the very first band, the band that is known for inventing rap metal.
The Public Enemy.
Before that. The Public Enemy worked with them because they had done a song called I'm the Man that they had played like 6 or 7 years, I want to say 7 years, before they did Bring the Noise. And with Public Enemy, but that was the thing, was they were like, look, rap and metal they're the same fucking thing, you know, that you can like them both. And at the time, people were like, no, you can't. Like, this is for black people and this is for white people. And in fact, this isn't even just for white people. This is for people who stand out in the schoolyard smoking cigarettes together behind the gym and wearing leather jackets and listening to this music. Like, it was not for everyone. And you kept your metal stations well away from the rock stations.
Sure.
And that was just how it was for a while. So it was not cool for the jocks to listen to metal. It was until the Metallica Black album. It was metal was never something a mainstream person would be caught listening to in high school. Like, it just wasn't a thing. Once Metallica's Black album came out, then at that point it was on and it was cool. And all of a sudden, you know, MTV was playing fucking Megadeth in primetime and it was fucking, you know, heavy metal awesome all the time. But for a very short window of time. But yeah, in this time, geek jocks picking on metalheads was a very normal thing, unless you had a large group of metalheads that all hung out together and were more punkish than heavy metal.
It just blows my mind that so much of their energy is focused on Weinbauer, especially since this movie comes out a year after The Breakfast Club, where you have a character like Judd Nelson, and you're like, who they at some point during the movie describe as a kid who gets high and listens to metal music.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like no one at Shermer High would dream of picking on Bender, but for some reason, like, all of
Eddie
hatred,
Weinbauer
just gets White all
power.
Of it. Weinbauer. So Weinbauer has one haven, and it's not just heavy metal music. Specifically, it's the music of one Sammy Kerr, who is his idol, his hero.
Who graduated from the same high school he did.
The same high school he did, and is kind of his beacon of hope of there is something better out. It's basically the proto.
It's the green light. It's the green light from Gatsby.
Yeah. Wow. Okay, yeah.
Sammy Kerr is the green light from Gatsby.
F. Scott Fitzgerald's Trick or Treat.
I kind of want to see that fucking movie.
The F stands for fuck yeah!
Fuck yeah!
So that's like the one hope he has that someday things are going to get better. And then he finds out that Sammy Kerr has died in a hotel fire and his world comes crashing down. And so he goes to cry on the shoulder of the local metal. This is the other thing that blows my mind.
Do you want me to tell this story? Because I love this story.
We should, go ahead. First of all, just before we get to the story, the fact that this town, where Weinbauer is the only metalhead in apparently a 3-mile radius, has its own heavy metal radio station.
To be fair, by heavy metal radio station, you mean a cinder block hut out in the middle of the desert outside of the town.
But it's a station within running distance, as we prove in the third act of this movie, of the high school that plays exclusively heavy metal music. Yeah. And then Lawrence Welk music for like 1 hour of the night, strangely. But anyway, yes, the story.
This is Nuke. Is the character who we only see once and then we hear two or three other times during the movie, played by a young gentleman named Gene Simmons.
So this already has another connection to One Junkie Summer right there.
But here's the thing. Gene Simmons was offered the role of Sammy Kerr, the villain of this movie. And he turned it down. And
why?
Why did he turn it down?
That's what I'm asking.
Because the script wasn't up to his caliber.
Well, that's good. That means he's very discerning in his project choices, and he obviously chose something of a higher quality, something that was, you know, more in keeping with his acting abilities and something that challenged him more. Like Never Too Young to Fucking Die.
Stargrove. Yeah, that's the movie. Keep this in mind. Trick or Treat.
He could have played two villains. No, this is what's great about this. He had the opportunity to play one of two villains in 1986, one of whom was a heavy metal god. Yeah, doesn't seem like
who gives himself over to Satan and becomes an awesome lesser demon fucking with a small town.
So not way outside of Gene Simmons' actual wheelhouse.
There you go.
The other was a hermaphroditic eco-terrorist who's the son of a master spy comes after, and that's what he chose. The latter.
He chose Hedwig.
He chose Hedwig instead. So
it was, it's a very, very, very strange choice on the part of Gene Simmons. And here's the thing, though, is while he turned that down, God damn it, is Gene Simmons charismatic and likable as Nuke?
Yeah, he really is.
Gene Simmons is someone who I love, you know, watching him perform in Kiss, especially back in the day, that was something to behold. He's somebody who in other media just kind of comes across as a turbo douche.
Oh, for sure.
Like such a turbo douche, like insufferable turbo douche. Like he's the heavy metal Donald Trump. Like it's really, like it's just, there's just something not quite right about him. But here in this movie, damn, is he a likable, feeling, heartfelt guy that you kind of feel like that might be the real Gene Simmons, like yeah. that laid back dude when the show's not on, like this is who he is.
Yeah.
And there's this great, because the whole thing is that this scene, this one scene we get with him, you know, Ragman goes in to talk to him about the death of Sammy Kerr, and he's like being real with him, and he's like, look, dude, he was angry all the time, even back in high school. He did this to himself.
Yeah.
Like, he put himself in this situation. He, you know, he's not this god.
Not something to be idolized.
He's just an angry guy who left us with some great music.
Mm-hmm.
And then he gives this album to Ragman.
It's the acetate of the last album that Sammy Kerr really hadn't fully released yet.
Yeah.
It's a studio acetate, so he lets him take it. He's going to be playing it at midnight on Halloween, fitting tribute. So Eddie takes the record and goes.
They've already recorded it, so he has no need for the acetate anymore. So he gives it to Eddie, who he knows is Sammy Kerr's biggest fucking fan. The movie opens with him writing a letter. A heartfelt letter to Sammy Kerr,
oh, yeah.
in which he utters my second favorite line in this whole fucking movie.
So many to choose from.
There's so many great ways to choose one from, but it's like you say, the metalheads will rule the apocalyptic wasteland.
He's not wrong. I mean, I've seen enough post-apocalyptic movies to know that they all look like heavy metal parking lots.
I love how serious and sincere he is saying about it, though. Like, it's some prophetic shit. Like, this is some heavy shit, dude. The metalheads will rule the apocalyptic wasteland. Like, that's deep. That's fucking deep. That touches my soul, man. And it's like, are you fucking kidding me? Like, that got the first big laugh out of the audience, which is kind of amazing, which also I feel is intentional as fuck.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's just, kind of how goopy the whole thing is. Like, intentionally so. Of course, the greatest line is, no whips, no false metal. Me and my wife, we literally wandered around my house at 4 o'clock in the morning drinking wine, still me still drunk from the movie, and yelling across the house, no whips,
no false metal. No, for sure. It's an amazing line. Unfortunately, part of the problem with this whole relationship is that Sammy wasn't just in league with the devil as part of his stage show. He was actually trying to sell his soul to Satan, and as a result, manages to use the record to come back and communicate with Eddie and then start to inflict punishment upon those people that Eddie has deemed, you know, his tormentors, and then that gets out of control, and there you have the movie.
And essentially, there's two ways to view this movie, which I find profoundly interesting. One is we're watching it from the point of view of this kid who's being ruthlessly bullied by these fucking asshole jocks. And as a result, uses this connection with this spirit talking to him on this record, which, by the way, we have not mentioned. How does he understand what Sammy Kerr is
masking.
Saying? He's playing the record backwards, and Sammy is talking to him from beyond the grave. So,
which is such a metal version of the Ouija board.
But at the same time, it's really, really funny because that was such a terrified. A tabloid reaction of the 80s that kids were being programmed by backmasking, which is the dumbest fucking thing on the planet.
Which is hilarious when you think one of the most notorious supposed backmaskings of all time was on a fucking Beatles record.
It really was. John is dead. And as we know, he was clearly dead and replaced by the guy that would go in front wings.
Yeah.
So,
Paul is a dead man. Miss him, apparently. But yeah.
Paul. Yes, I said John. I meant Paul.
Which is... Yeah, so that kind of spirals out of control, and there you get a lot of the sort of the Carrie elements of this movie. You get there's at one point in this movie where Sammy is controlling appliances and electricity, and I was just like, what a great Spider-Man story this would have been.
Well, that's the other element of the story. The first one is this horror film about this kid who his revenge goes too far, and it cuts loose and takes on a life of its own. The other way to look at it is this heavy metal rock god creates a ritual and sacrifices himself to Satan so that he can go on and join Satan.
Yeah.
Only to become a lesser demon that spends Halloween night tormenting a small town by driving cars around and zapping kids in a high school gym.
Yeah.
Like that's like, this is what Sammy Kerr is doing to impress Satan. Is he's killing a couple of teenagers with electricity and like turning on blenders.
I feel like as soon as Sammy gets back to hell, he's going to be picked on just like Eddie was by the other demons.
You kind of think that where like, yeah. You know, there's real legitimate demons down there going,
where are the rest of your pants, Sammy? Yeah, those look real like, tight, yeah. Sammy. Where are the rest of your pants?
Yeah, like Hitler's pantsing him in the locker room.
What are those chaps? You look real pretty, sweetheart. Yeah, I feel like that's going to be definitely part of his torment.
But so all this stuff we've talked about, like what it gets about heavy metal, not only is Gene Simmons in this, but there's also a great appearance by Ozzy Osbourne as a preacher talking on television about the evils of heavy metal.
And that is the definitive point in this movie where you realize that it has a major sense of humor about all this and isn't like the other heavy metal horror movies that are legitimately that kind of feel
like Black Roses and
yeah,
things like that.
Yeah, that do, like, as fun as they are, feel like somebody made it thinking they were saying something, thinking they were like, this is the warning to parents, or at least like, I'm capitalizing on the evil of black metal to sell this movie. No, this is a movie that fully understands how ridiculous the panic around heavy metal is and is exploiting that and making fun of that. And one of my favorite parts is, of course, Ozzy Osbourne at possibly his most coherent ever.
Oh, yeah.
Because you can understand what he's saying. Is this televangelist just going on this rant about, this is all evil, and let me read these lyrics, and there's just, it's just over sexualized.
It's some of the sexualization. He's like, what's wrong with I Love You?
What happened to the classic love songs?
Yeah, singers used to say I love you, and now it's all about sticking your love rocket into me. Like, it's hilarious, and he's legitimately funny. In those sequences, which is kind of cool that they keep playing with this local television stuff, because that's one of the weird things that Sammy Kerr can do is he's like augmenting and tweaking reality. Like he can reach into the television and pull people out through the cameras out into, you know, the other room and burn them to a crisp. Like it's super bizarre and crazy and weird.
Yeah.
But in all the right ways. And we keep talking about how intentionally funny it is. There are a few moments where we've talked about in a couple of previous episodes about where 86 is where like films of these genres started actually really playing around with meta.
Yeah.
And that was not something you typically did, and how, you know, Friday the 13th Part 6.
Yeah.
Was like the meta horror movie that kind of changed horror movies. This has a few moments dabbling with meta. My favorite being the one where, you know, we've got Ragman running away from the high school gymnasium. You know, we've got the police after him. We've got Sammy hot on their heels. And the love interest, she's following close behind him, running after him. And he just goes, why are you following me? And she just goes, I don't know. Like, it's like they address the fact that, no, there's no reason these two characters should be running together at this point in time, but we're putting them together anyway, and fuck it. And they just went with it, and it's hilarious.
Yeah.
Because they know that they need the characters together. The audience knows the characters need to be together, because we kind of want to see him end up with his love interest. And they just go for it and just say, fuck it. Not gonna have a real reason, and it's hilarious. And there's several little moments like that throughout the movie that just really drive home what they were trying to make. And of course, there's an excellent kill with a demon that is hilarious. Just there's a woman who is possessed and clearly getting cunnilingus from a demon. You assume it's Sammy from Beyond the Grave.
No, it's a gargoyle puppet.
Yeah, he looks up and it's this big, goofy plastic puppet. It's fucking hilarious.
And what's crazy about that is, and they do this so well, is they pair that moment, which will inspire some laughter just because the way it's shot and the look of the puppet, with the fact that this girl's ears have melted off listening
in
to the
great effect,
to the Walkman.
Like, yeah, they take the Walkman ears off and like this pink gooey flesh just like pulls away. It's so gross in the best way.
One of two Videodrome moments in this movie, I feel.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. It's this movie's just. It knows what it is, and it's fun about it.
Yeah.
It's just goddamn fun. Like, it's one of those movies that if you look at it on the surface, you're like, "This is so basic. It's so easy. It's so cheap." And it earns everything along the way, and you just have fun with it. It never slows down or gets boring. There's never that 5-minute bit where it's like, okay, I can get up and go to the bathroom now because this movie's just slowed down, and this isn't the best part of the movie. No, it is tight and fun all the way through.
Yeah.
It is just how this movie didn't connect and do well is just a testament to how crazy a year 86 was, which is very much like the summer we're looking at now.
Yeah.
Where you have everybody saying, wow, this is the worst summer for box office in 15 years. And it's loaded with genre, but people are just kind of like, we're done with it. And that's how people were then. And this movie sadly got neglected after a summer of neglected genre movies.
And I want to talk about another reason this movie really earns everything that we're saying about it is the villain. The two components of the villain,
oh yes,
are the performance by Tony Fields and the music of Fastway, which is the band that did all the music for this movie and kind of they provide all of the Sammy Kerr tracks. Now, something interesting about Fastway that I looked up, it's a former Motorhead guitarist, Eddie Clark, and vocalist Dave King, who people probably know now as the vocalist for Flogging Molly.
Yeah.
Which is a crazy combination of people to put together for this very, like, it's supposed to be like dark black metal, but it's the sound of it, it's hair metal.
Yeah.
Like, it's totally fucking hair metal.
Oh, it's butt rock.
It is definitely butt rock.
And it is a great butt rock. And it's butt rock that I did not know how many of my friends loved. Like, I knew that a bunch of my friends would love this movie, and I'd get, you know, a dozen people, like, when I announced the movie, would be like, yeah! Half of those people went home and immediately took pictures and posted on Facebook of their trick-or-treat albums by Fastway.
Yeah.
Like, they still had them. They dug them out. They threw them on. They dug out their vinyl, threw it on, and just rocked out to it after the movie. The soundtrack's fucking good. Like, these people this is not something you could go out and buy a couple years ago. This is something you had to buy 30 years ago and still have.
Yes. It is also, by the way, available on Spotify because I rocked that shit all the way home from the screening. I'm just going to play a little sample of it right here. Fucking awesome! Like, it's just like, yeah, it's dumb, but it's so much fucking
Stargrove.
No, but it does tell you to, you know, to tear down the walls. And that's the other thing too, is the music is so beautifully on the nose.
Oh, but that's the exact word.
Stand up, tear down the walls, scream.
Tear down the walls is when he's tearing all the posters off his walls.
Literally. And then Don't Stop the Fight when it's like when he's turning the tables on the bullies and it's like, there's a song called It's Up to You Now. Come on, guys.
That turning the tables on the bully scene, might be one of the best turning the tables on the bully scenes I've ever seen. Like, yeah. Not only in terms of the satisfaction of how the bullies get it and how he gets the bullies to actively fuck themselves over, but the scene when they're running through the school and they get to the library and the bullies want to run through the library, but they can't get in trouble, so they do that
fast walk.
The chest forward fast walk.
Yes.
Like with their fists clenched, like power walking through. So we're not running through the library.
Not running through the library.
And the minute they get to the end, like tearing off. Like it's like, yes, who didn't do that in high school at one point in time where you're like, oh, I'm not running. This is clearly not running, but I'm going very fast.
Can't bust me for this. Or my favorite part is the gravity defying bully. Who, when he throws
he throws
a bucket of water on the ground. Now, if you watch this scene carefully, the bully doesn't actually ever touch the water. He flies before he gets to the water and literally has to be, 100 feet out this door.
Like, seriously, that kid got injured, if not ended up dead. Like, that kid was paralyzed after that, and nobody ever talked about the fact that Ragman paralyzed a kid.
Which you'd think would have at least made the school paper, if nothing else.
But no, that little douche canoe just vanishes out the door, never be heard from again.
And he's gone. All to the screaming chords of Fastway, which is such a fun soundtrack, really gets you pumped and in the mood. And then, like I said before, the other part of this character is Tony Fields' performance. And Tony Fields is a guy who started out as a dancer for Michael Jackson. Like, he did work in the Thriller video. He's in Captain EO.
Is he human?
What?
Or is he... never mind.
I was like, yes, he is, in fact, a human. So
he's not a dancer.
He's not a...
One or the other. Like, if we learned anything from pop music recently.
No, that's true. No, he is one of those rare Venn diagrams. He's both a human and a dancer.
Wow.
Yeah. Crazy how that works. But he is really tasked with doing only one thing in this movie, and he does it well, which is just... make a big scary face. Just make like a wide-eyed grimace and just kind of hold his head up and like that perfect giant hairsprayed, coif.
I would disagree. There are two things he does in this movie, bordering on three.
Okay.
No,
it's the two almost three things.
The
guys.
Other thing is the dancer training, which he struts around like a real rock god. Like, this is not one of those instances where it's like, oh, he's goofing around and this is silly and they think this is what heavy metal looks like. It's like, oh, no, this is what heavy metal look like. Like,
that's
this
true.
Guy,
no, he totally gets that.
He gets that. And then the other thing is then he occasionally turns slowly to the camera and growls out awesome fucking lines that are so fucking metal.
Speaking of the strutting around, the way he looks and the specificity of his strutting, do you know who he fucking reminded me of?
Trash?
Yes, Trash!
How did I know you were going for Trash?
Fucking Trash from 1990 Bronx Warriors. That's the whole time I'm watching him like, yeah, he's kind of like Trash. I'm getting a Trash vibe.
What are you trying to say?
I'm not trying to. You're the one that called him inhuman because he's a dancer.
I'm just saying, Trash, the man that Fred the Hammer Williamson once referred to as so light on his feet, he didn't leave tracks in the snow.
I would also describe Sammy Kerr, but that's because he's the undead and probably also doesn't leave tracks. But yeah, there's so many great, I want to go back for just a second to these bullies who, typical of the 80s, are just like...
Oh, they're all blonde. They all have popped collars.
They're all 35, and they all just hate everyone who's not them, like with a viciousness that you don't get in any other movies. Like this era of filmmaking where the bullies were just total sociopaths. It's borderline Stephen King bullies.
Well, the 80s were very much a time where it was all about, before then, bullying was just an accepted boys will be boys thing. And this was the era where it was like, hey, you know what? Not only is this bad, but they make really great villains and we can humiliate all these guys in retrospect that humiliated us as children.
Yeah.
And it became like the okay thing to do to the point of, like these are not quite Stephen King villains,
but they're close.
They're close. Like when they push him into the pool and drop the barbell in his bag,
it's like, haha, he's gonna die.
He's drowning in the pool. Yeah, it's pretty close to a Stephen King bully.
And of course, the other important thing about an '80s bully is the classism, because they're all fucking rich, and they're yuppie to the point that they literally. There's a great scene, and this made me laugh so hard, where they come into the metal shop and they've just been busted. Ragman has found a way to make them basically bust themselves with the teachers, and then they're sentenced to janitorial work. And they come in, and these two bullies who are both wearing shirts and ties and going, "We just spent the last several hours doing janitorial duty. We had to scrape stuff out of the bottom."
Thin ties, by the
thin
way.
Thin ties.
Razor thin ties.
And they're like, "We had to scrape stuff off the bottom of people's desks and do all this janitor work." And I remember leaning over to Martin, who was sitting next to me, and going, "Then why are you wearing ties? If you just got done doing janitor work, why are you?
What? You know why they were wearing ties.
Well, no,
they needed it for what was about to happen.
Yeah, but it's still like, what? Like, you need, it's convenient that they happen to be wearing ties, which makes no sense for doing janitor work, but it's like, oh, his tie is what gets stuck in the press, and it looks like the drill, which, by the way, kind of wanted that drill to just go through that dude's head. Like, kind of wanted my Fulci moment.
Yeah, except that moment there is essential, because that's the moment that shows us that Ragman is actually,
he's got limits.
He's got a soul, that he's a dude. Like, he's already transgressed at this point.
But he hasn't killed anybody.
I'm wrong. He hasn't transgressed at this point. This is right before he transgresses. So this is before he goes and makes the tape to make the peace offering that then ends up killing the girl, who also is a bully in her own right. That scene with her is actually harsher and more hateful than anything those jock bullies do, because during their whole period, they're just like cutting holes in his milk so it pours milk on him, and they're, you know, pushing him out into the girls' gym while, you know, and yanking his towel off. Like, she actually just walks up and like, "I have a question for you. Doesn't it take too much effort to be this creepy?
Yeah.
Like, you know, don't you get tired of just being a creeper? Like, why can't you act normal?" Like, she's just like this guy's already been humiliated and asked to leave a place that he was invited to by the girl of his dreams.
Yeah.
And here's this, you know, one of the school hotties, like, just dressing him down in front of everybody in the most humiliating, like, emasculating way. Like, it's just, it's one of those insults that just, there's no way to get around. Like, "Hey, he's a guy who listens to heavy metal and kind of keeps to himself. Oh no, you're a creep." And that just, like, that moment is just kind of, I think, crystallizes everything that I think is right about the character of Ragman. Like, this is one of the neat things about this movie, is just how right they get that loner kind of mentality without mocking it. It feels very like he Ragman does feel like a character that in the first act of this movie very much belongs in a John Hughes movie. Now, he becomes like goopy afterwards, where once he starts getting his revenge and he's got his demon best friend, heavy metal rocker, then he becomes like kind of douchey to the point of like, "Dude, the girl you've been pining after for an entire act and a half of the movie is trying to have a conversation with you, and you're like too cool for school all of a sudden."
Yeah.
Like, fuck off. Sammy's not getting you laid. Like, what the hell are you doing?
Yeah.
Like, dude, like, that's the moment where you're like, all right, now this is becoming a Friday night movie, but okay. And it works, because we need to kind of see him drunk on the power before he fully rejects the power. But that scene that you're talking about, he has to stop.
Oh, no, I get machine. Why. I'm just saying, I wanted to see thing go through the dude's head. Like, I wanted my Fulci moment.
Oh yeah, well, because that guy's it. But we get the revenge on him, though. Like, that's even better, because that scene is so good. So yeah. After his girlfriend gets raped by a demon and gets demon cunnilingus
this week on Lifetime, raped by a demon.
And that's a dip. Yeah, and that stars a very different Family Ties person. That's a Meredith Baxter Burney movie.
Oh, okay. I thought we were just going to talk about the entity for a while. It's like, okay, I'm sorry.
No, but so he,
Ron Silver, get out of here.
He's furious, and the his girlfriend's put in the hospital. So he hops in his fucking powered, you know, his fucking souped up car, drives up onto Eddie Weinbauer's lawn. And
Eddie who?
Weinbauer.
Screaming.
Eddie who?
Weinbauer.
Eddie Weinbauer.
Weinbauer. He's saying Weinbauer, but the way he's saying it, with the rage he's saying it with, and the audience
Weinbauer!
At the screening was laughing.
Weinbauer!
Everybody was laughing at this, because it sounds like he's saying white power.
Weinbauer!
Over and over and over again. And I'm like, this completely yuppie 80s, you know, Aryan douchebag is screaming white power outside the house of someone named Weinbauer.
And yeah. Yeah.
Guys.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of special. And then
Part of me thinks that wasn't an accident.
I'm not certain that it is. Then Ragman walks out onto the lawn, and he's walking up, and he's ready to beat the shit out of him. And all Ragman does is put his hand out to steady him, and the dude's like, oh, fuck, dude. And he, like, backs away.
The jack-o'-lanterns flicker.
And it's like, oh, shit. And he's like, I don't want to piss off the creepy demon kid. Like, this is really, like, this kid's like, what the fuck did you do to her, man? He's like, what? What the fuck did you put on that tape? You listened to the tape? You weren't supposed to. Oh, my God. Like, it's like, it's hilarious because all of a sudden he starts shrinking back and he's just like, and you could see the moment on his face. And this is what's so cool. Like, that actor, oddly enough, the preppy douchebag is the guy who had the biggest career out of this movie, aside from Gene Simmons and Ozzy Osbourne. Like, the only regular character in this movie that would go on to, like, big things, because he went on to become a big TV actor on, like, Desperate Housewives and things like that.
Oh, wow.
He's had a long career. The guy's still fucking acting. As a kid 30 years ago, he played a douchebag jock in a fucking 80s movie.
Doug Savant.
Yeah. And so...
That's the definition of a Doug Savant, right? Like, somebody who you don't think much of at first, and then they star in Desperate Housewives.
Yeah. But for like a decade. That's a gig, dude.
The real Doug Savant.
Yeah. So here's what's great about it is there's this look on his face. There's this moment where you see him thinking about it, where he has that realization, why the fuck did I come to threaten the demon kid? Yeah. Like, why did I do this? Like, why am I here? Like, that moment is so great and it's so cathartic for the audience, but it's also really cool to find this character, because when he starts backing away, once he's had that look and he goes to get back in his car, you know that kid's never fucking with Ragman again.
Yeah.
Like, the fact that he doesn't show up in the rest of the movie to get any kind of revenge, that dude is scared out of his fucking wits, and that moment broke him when he realized, I was all alpha male for a while, but I'm the beta in this situation, so I'm going to get the fuck out of here, but I'll try to alpha out by, you stay the fuck away from me, man!
Which is hilarious, because that effectively means he drove over to Weinbauer's house to tell him to stay away from him.
But it's, you could tell at first that's not his goal until he realizes, because he has that profound moment of, why did I fucking do this? And it's just such a great small snippet of beautiful acting on the part of Doug Savant. That just it makes that entire character's arc so worth it. Like, it's better than him getting a drill through the head. The moment of him shrinking like a violet away from fucking Ragman is just so gloriously entertaining. That is just a wonderful, wonderful moment. And then, of course, we don't need him, because the rest of the movie gets fucking bonkers ape shit from there.
Oh yeah, this is the thing too about this movie. Like, we're talking about how meta it is, we're talking about how clever it is, and the things that are legitimately good about it. There is plenty about this movie that works on that kind of midnight movie level. There's lot of, like, really goofy shit in this movie.
Oh, like the scene where they almost kill Sammy Kerr with a toilet?
With a toilet. And by that, we don't mean they hit him over the head with it, or they, like, put his face in it and try to drown him.
He is somehow tied into electricity.
He's Electro. He goes full on Electro in the third act of this movie.
Well. And starts zapping people, moves around through
the radios specifically.
Through radios, yeah. Speakers, things like that. He can, you know, find his way onto cassette tapes, things of that nature.
Things of this nature.
And he gets his hand put in a toilet, and he's electrocuting, because apparently no water for Sandy
Which
Kerr.
Which you can kind of understand, except for how fucking long this goes on.
Oh, no. The beauty of it, and this is the beautiful comedy of it, is right just as you think he's going to pull his hand out of the toilet and return to fucking with them, the girl leans over and flushes it.
Which is hilarious, because his hand is a good 4 feet out of the toilet at this point, and then somehow magnetically goes back into it when she flushes. I don't think they understand how plumbing works, because that's not how plumbing works.
I thought it was pretty fucking funny.
And it's like, hilarious, because
the timing, the comedic timing of the flush is so elegant and so well done. Like, it's one of those things that, like, the small moments that really work here, this is the great thing when you have an actor turned director that gets that kind of stuff. Because that's exactly these great moments are just, they're just about the right perfect amount of timing. And he nails that comedy on that flush, to where the audience was just rolling in the fucking aisles at that flush, as you're supposed to. Like, it's tension, humor. And the humor just pops. And then you get to catch your breath, And then it becomes pure tension again. And then we get some really cool scenes that follow up of them continually trying to escape this fucking demonic thing.
Yeah. And it's what's crazy about it is it goes on to a length that they actually get outside or trying to start the car. And then the girl looks up at the window that's flashing with the electricity and the screaming, and she kind of, and they cut away, and then they cut back to her, and she looks again, and it's still going on, as if to say, like, wow, really? That's still fucking happening? Okay, I guess that worked out better than anyone could have possibly imagined. And then, of course, there's the scene where he inhabits Eddie's mom's station wagon, and it, like, backs out of the driveway and
disappears. And starts driving around the block in reverse.
Well, you think it's, like, disappeared, and they have to get another car, and then here it comes again, like the fucking Griswold family truckster.
Well, but that's the moment where I was like, man, this is a small-time demon. Like, up until this point, you think Sammy Kerr is like he's, you know, he's fucking Freddy Krueger. He's Jason Voorhees. He's kind of this lesser demon who's fucking around on Halloween night and thinks he's fucking metal as fuck. Like, it's all kind of glorious on this other level of just how small potatoes a scary demonic entity is. It's like, he's getting pantsed by Hitler and the demon from The Exorcist. Like,
Pazuzu is full on giving this guy a swirly.
That is they are not even in the same league.
No.
It's like, really? You couldn't kill Skippy from Family Ties?
No, they have a regular dodgeball game with, like, they use the heads of pedophiles as dodgeballs, and this guy's getting pelted every single time. Like,
I used to be so cool. I like, no wimps. No false metal.
I love that in our wildest imagination, hell is basically just a high school. Like, it works exactly like an 80s high school.
Come on.
It's
that
just
much
in
evil
hell
down there. It's got to be fucking
That's
high
true.
School.
That's true, for sure. Speaking of high school, this has another of my favorite tropes from weirdo 80s horror movies. The big dance scene where people are in costumes. I love 80s movies with Halloween or costume balls, and you just see some of the weird shit that people dress up as.
That one costume that killed the audience.
Oh my God, I was rolling. I know exactly. It's somebody actually at this party dressed up as one of the fucking animals from the Rock of Fire explosion, which was the...
Oh, was that the one that... Oh, because I was actually... The one that was killing people up in my section was the girl dressed as the box of Special K.
Oh, yeah. No, that was good,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, somebody dressed up as the bear from Rock of Fire explosion, too. That was pretty great.
Yeah, like, not only did they dress up, you see them several times. It's a very, like, unwieldy costume.
There's a bunch of great costumes
in there. But at one point, they take the bear out on a stretcher, and it's just like... What the fuck?
People were getting electrocuted.
Yeah.
Where Sammy Kerr was playing and electrocuting his audience.
And that's the moment where I was like, oh my God, like, I'm not kidding. This would have made an awesome Spider-Man story, because you have Electro attacking the prom and swinging off of the fucking rafters. And I'm like, dude, Spider-Man should come in here and save us now that Eddie has bitched out and run away. Like, yeah, we need an actual hero to come in.
He kind of spends most of the movie bitching out after the fact.
He just runs. The whole third act is him like, I need to go here. Oh, no, that didn't work. I guess I should run here. And I'm like, you know how to hotwire a vehicle. We see you do it. Like, try doing it to a different vehicle, for crying out loud. Because through most of the movie, he's running across fields. Like, I hope I don't miss all the action. You missed most of the action. But yeah, this, and then, of course, we get our scene at the end where the bully, who is now lost his girlfriend, is going after the girl that Eddie likes, but he's, like, drunk and rapey about it, so she, you know, tells him where to go, and then Sammy gets a hold of him and just fucking... Speaking of Halloween, the way this is blocked is almost the exact same as the kill in Halloween, where they stick the boyfriend to the wall with the knife, because he picks him up on the wall, and then you see his feet dangling, and you see him, like, on the edge of the ceiling, and then you see Sammy kind of doing the head tilt, and it's very Michael Myers sticking the boyfriend to the wall with a knife, except that he... you know, disintegrates him with electricity, which is actually pretty cool. So, yeah, but that whole ending is just, it's a lot of cheese packed into a very tight container. And it still works pretty damn well.
But it knows that it is. Like, that's exactly the movie they set out to make. And that's this is not a movie that tried to be scary and failed and became goofy fun to, you know, chomp popcorn and down a sixer and make fun of. No, this is a movie that is having fun with you, that it's like, it's okay to enjoy movies like this, and we're making one for you.
Yeah.
This is, you know, a Saturday night horror flick. Like, that's exactly what this wants to be. And this wants to be a midnight movie. So it's perfect to show it at midnight on a Saturday night at the fucking Draft House. It just played like fucking gangbusters, man.
Yeah, and I highly recommend, if you like this movie and you're interested in this genre, movies like Black Roses, movies like Demons, movies like Phantom of the Paradise, movies like The Gate. Actually, funny enough, a lot of lists have Friday the 13th Part 6 as a heavy metal horror movie. So there's just a lot of shit out there to choose from.
You know what this movie caused me and my wife to discuss? There's a movie that we desperately need to cover on the show that neither you nor I have ever mentioned covering.
Night of the Demons, of course, is another one. What's that?
We need to cover Six String Samurai.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, I've heard nothing but good things about
it. Oh, have you
movie.
Not seen Six String
Samurai? No, I have not.
Oh, my God, dude. Oh my God! Was that ever a movie made for fucking us?
Awesome!
Like, holy shit! Yeah, well, that will happen sooner rather than later. I will see to that.
Awesome! Slumber Party Massacre 2, Terror Vision. Yeah, there's a shit ton of heavy metal horror.
Terror
movies.
Vision was on my short list of things that I was thinking of playing. Also, Night Train to Terror.
Oh my God!
They have a 35 print of Night Train to Terror.
Oh, don't.
That I almost tormented the audience with, and then zigged and showed this.
Oh my
Instead.
God! You made the right zig. Oh my God! Night Train of Terror is.
Oh, I know.
Oh, I know.
But fortunately,
it's indescribably bad. Like, it is three bad movies. It's three incomplete bad movies jammed into one
that
horrific bad.
You know,
movie.
You can get it on like DVD and Blu-ray now with the complete movies.
Oh,
that are complete.
I've seen at least one of those. By the way. When two of your three movies in your anthology star Bull from Night Court.
Richard Mull.
Hey. Just take that into consideration. That's all I'm saying.
No wimps. No false metal.
And that brings us to the junk food pairing, which, Cargill, this one was easy because it was actually provided during the screening by your wife.
Oh, fuck yeah. Which was her idea, by the
way.
She was
brilliant.
Like, this is what we have to do.
It was a brilliant companion to the film itself. She passed out little jack-o'-lantern-shaped trick-or-treat bags with candy in them, and I was just like, I'm sucking down all of the processed sugar, and it's perfect. Like, I feel like a little kid again.
I'm so glad you feel that way, because we ended up with some extra candy here. We ended up with, because for some reason, the bag she bought had extra Whoppers in it. So in honor of you the other night, I had my first experience with Whopcorn. I made Whopcorn.
Yay!
And Jessica's like, Whopcorn? And I was like, she's like, that sounds offensive. And I said, well, it is Brian.
It's the food that sounds racist, but I promise it's not. That's the jingle for Whopcorn.
That should be the jingle for Whopcorn, and which was excellent, actually. It was something I had never considered.
Right?
Whoppers and popcorn. Whopcorn was, and I think this is a Whopcorn movie.
Oh yeah, if there's one thing I'm good at, it's defiling myself with food. So. Food and drink.
Thank you for that image.
You're welcome.
Thank you for that image.
It sounds offensive, but I promise it is.
I just kind of have this image of you with Whopper, Whopper anal beads.
Oh, yeah. What the hell did you think I was talking about? Come on.
And you don't even pull it slow. You pull it like a chainsaw.
I don't think you ate Whopcorn the way you were supposed to. I don't think you really experienced Whopcorn the way I had in mind, but I'm going to mercifully end the show
before we get any further.
Before we get banned by parent groups like Heavy Metal did. But if you would like to hear more of these disgusting musings, you can always find us on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema. You can like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. Rate us and review us on iTunes. That really helps. And if you really want to help out, you can become a patron at patreon.com/junkfoodcinema. That $300 level will allow patrons to torture me with movies. So definitely.
And it also lets you get access to a bunch of the cool things that we record just for patrons.
Yeah.
Which are mailbags, our reviews of new movies.
Yeah.
Like in the recent past, we've talked about Lights Out and the really amazing
Don't Breathe.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, please join us over there as well.
Cargo, where can people find you on the internet?
You can find me on Twitter at MassaWyrm. That's MassaWyrm. And at facebook.com/MassaWyrm.
All right. You can find me on Twitter at BryGuySalisbury, or my Facebook page is facebook.com/BryanSalisburyCritic. And yeah, like I said, rate and review us on iTunes. But I'm going to end this show with a very valuable piece of advice. Besides, of course, no wimps, no false metal.
And besides putting Whoppers in popcorn and buttering it up a little.
Yeah, absolutely. You should be loyal to your heroes because they can turn on you.
They can turn on you. They can turn on you.
Every weekend. Oh, snoof. Still, I'm going to laugh. It's that I don't mind. No, I'm sure.